Hello and welcome to the fourth episode of the Hopkins Green Tea, a podcast from the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. I'm Amethyst Devlin, and I'm joined by my co-hosts,
Leonie Kida,
Abigail Hunter,
Shada Hushmandi.
Over the first few episodes of our podcast, we've taken on the complexity of the IRA, and we've shared more with you about what got us here and what assignments Abigail was avoiding in order to record this podcast. In this episode, we're excited for the opportunity to bring these topics back around to our overarching goal of this podcast, which is to bring these large topics into a format that's easy to understand and relate to, even if you don't work in this field yet. This month's episode is focused on greenwashing, and we are honored to be joined by another guest, and Shada will be introducing her.
Our guest, Dori Dhanahari, has a wide-ranging experience in the strategic problem-facing industries. After a career as a management consultant, now she has a portfolio of interests and is a board member of a number of organizations, including the investment committee of a significant corporate venture where she performs strategic marketing due diligence. For one of the largest chemical companies in the world, with a focus on delivering more green and innovative solutions, as well as an early stage agri-tech company called Novihome and a pre-IPO unicorn in Israel with a unique technology, a global multi-family office and independent investment firm where she works on direct investments. Dori has sat for many years on the board of trustees of several charities in the UK and Africa. She was the chair of the London Development and a trustee of Maggie's Cancer Care and the Persia Educational Foundation. She is the founder of DDH Consultants, working with Fortune 500 companies on growth and innovation. Dori believes for facing climate change, we'd have to be pragmatic and attempt to find solutions beneficial for all parties involved. Dori, it's a pleasure to have you on our podcast.
Well, it's a total pleasure. Indeed, it really is. And it's such an interesting topic, and I can't wait to get into it. And I'm honored to have been asked to join.
So as Amethyst mentioned, our topic is greenwashing. And it's easy to get confused when it comes to the definition of the word greenwashing. People tend to use greenwashing, impact washing, and ESG interchangeably. So to start our conversation, please tell our audience what we mean when we say greenwashing.
Shada, this is a very good start. It is very confusing, and all these jargons, a green, ESG, impact, washing, hushing, all these things are interchangeably used, and there is really no universal definition that everybody adheres to. However, if we really wanted to start with something, we could say greenwashing is when actually a company is claiming their business practice or products are sustainable when they really aren't. And this is often done to really attract lots of attention from the consumer, socially and environmentally conscious people who are now becoming more and more aware. But however, it backfires because the consumer is intelligent and it finds out that it's not the truth. And sometimes also not just the consumer, but it eventually gets found out and it becomes a negative press and negative energy for the customer loyalty of that company. So the best example or the most famous example of greenwashing is the Volkswagen emissions scandal, where it was found that deliberately they rigged their diesel engines to fake the amount of emission products. And there are, of course, other examples that are less malicious, but it is really very much part of our society right now, where companies are telling us that they are doing something green when they really aren't. So if we then look at impact washing, is when a fund manager or a bond issuer overstate or falsely claim an investment positive impact on an environment and society. And the difference between impact and green is really, really important to distinguish, because impact is a strategy, whilst green or ESG with the ESG charter, UN charter, is really a framework which has got some measurement possibilities.
Yeah, there is a many reason why company engage in greenwashing. It is possible for greenwashing to occur as a result of corporate ignorance. However, a company is often incentivized to make its profit more attractive to consumers, thereby increasing sales volume or enabling price rise. So what do you think the drivers of greenwashing?
Well, definitely is the consumer demand. There's absolutely no doubt about it that if you say something is green, you immediately, particularly because of the Z-gen and the new generation, where we are much more aware of the impact that we're making on our environment, and people are really very much driven to say, I would like to buy something that is not going to damage the world and damage the future of my children and the people who are going to inherit this earth from me. And so that awareness has made a lot of pressure on companies to start really saying, you know, playing up the game and saying, we have got a green product. However, that in itself is becoming a little bit the other way around. And that's where we've got, I mean, I'm trying to not use too much jargon, but then that leads in itself to greenwashing, because there's become so much pressure on companies when they've made a commitment that later on they can't actually achieve. And so therefore they get into trouble. So it backfires in a big way. So we do have an issue here whereby the driver is really the consumer. And of course, the government comes into play because they want to make regulations to put the demand of the consumer in the right place. So we have a demand from the consumer, the role of the government and the regulatory, and finally, the role of the entrepreneurs and technology, where I am really involved, where technology can really help get over some of these real issues.
If I may too, I just think that like that brings up such a good point in regards to the consumer decisions. Like for so long, sustainability, environment, all of this like work towards climate change has really been put on the consumer. Companies have really thrived in doing that, making it all about consumer decisions. And I think that that has fueled a lot of the greenwashing as well, because it kind of opened up this opportunity to see that it was being put on individuals and target those individuals.
In a sense, the individual is very important, because some of the individuals, when, for example, don't have the know-how or the knowledge. So, for example, if you come out and you're wearing jeans and your nice, beautiful sneakers, and you drive a car and you say no more fossil fuels or no more plastic from tomorrow, you're not actually being realistic. So being pragmatic and figuring out how, as consumers, we can actually put demands on the companies to really this transitionary period whereby we can gradually, through the utilization of technology, overcome some of the major issues. So the example of that is, for example, the ozone layer, where there was a depletion in the ozone layer, and then the regulatories came in place, and of course then the companies suddenly jumped to it and managed to overcome this ban on CFC very quickly.
So just to, we're digressing kind of from the script here, but I want to kind of piggyback on what you just said in Amethyst's question or point. So with the ozone layer example and kind of the question of the consumer role in all of this, all I remember in that time period when they were overcoming that challenge and the regulations were hailed as being highly successful was this decision or this pressure on consumers to stop using hairspray. And so I'm just curious, like what you think is the most important thing? Is it the regulation side of things that ends up being the most integral, that relationship between governments and companies in evoking change? Or is kind of consumer demand for these things with a critical thinking actually going to also help push that?
I think that's a very good question, because it's a combination of the lot. It's neither one thing or the other. We are talking about a period whereby there's a real tectonic plates are changing, and the consumer is becoming far more powerful today than it's ever been. So therefore, the consumer demand is one of the key areas of change, pressure for change towards the big corporates. The big corporates can no longer just give us whatever they want and just assume that we will take it and say no problem. But at the same time, I'm saying the consumer has got to be slightly more pragmatic as well. So I give you an example. If you are saying that every single person in the world has got to become vegan and not eat meat, it's not going to happen. But at the same time, obviously, the impact that cows have on, you know, both for dairy and as well as meat on the environment is huge. So we've got to do something about methane. OK, so by actually saying let's cull all the cows, we're not, I mean, the demand, that demand, which might come from some militant consumers, is not acceptable. So therefore, we can't suddenly have a regulation saying no more cows. But what we can do is to use that pressure that is coming right at us from the fact that we cannot have this methane. At the moment, for example, there's some really seriously high-tech solutions of how this methane could be reduced by actually giving cows certain type of food or managing that process. And in fact, in reality, because of technology being so much better, we need less cows to give us the same amount of milk. So therefore, there is a real combination of the demand from the consumer plus the technology, plus what is really happening, you know, the government side. All of these hand in hand will make the right changes rather than one thing only.
That makes a lot of sense. We can kind of see it through like a triangular prism maybe. And what you just said is a really good way to lead into our next question in terms of what's actually pragmatic in terms of these sustainability commitments and how that impacts the increasing cases of greenwashing that we see. And we wanted to kind of speculate, you know, greenwashing cases have maybe increased as a result of these pressures on business to make environmental commitments, and then whether or not they can meet them is to TBD down the line, to be determined. So, for example, we talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but the auto industry has these incredible commitments to decarbonize their fleets by certain time periods. BMW says they're going to have half their sales by battery cars in 2030. Bentley says no more combustion engines by 2030. Ford and GM are committed to carbon neutrality by 2050 and 2040, respectively. And then Honda says they want to phase out gas cars by 2040. These are huge statements that they're making. And I do believe they're making it in good faith, but there's so many external variables that could prevent them from actually accomplishing them. So how does that play into greenwashing? If it's, you know, we're in the right place, they're trying to make these goals, what onus on the company do they have to actually make attainable goals versus kind of as they look against government pressure they're getting to make some sustainability commitments as well?
Yeah, I think that's, again, a really good question, because, I mean, obviously, the optic that I'm coming from, and I hope you will realize, is from the investment side, because obviously I'm involved in technology and investment in the tech area whereby we can find solutions. So impact investing is really my area. Rather than, I would say, ESG or green per se, because it's the strategy of making sure that we are actually investing in things that we really actually have an impact. The problem with impact investing, there is no regulatory affairs, or there is no measurement policy of really deciding whether that actually really is making an impact. Let me give you some figures. For example, $2.3 trillion of asset with intent of impact have been raised. Out of those, only 400 billion have managed to actually go and produce into things that are actually impact. So therefore, there's a lot of money chasing not enough supply. So this is happening at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, obviously, the auto companies in particular, obviously making all these amazing commitments, whether they can achieve it or not, because we also have to really look at cradle to grave when we're looking at the measurement. Are we really measuring or not? Because in some ways, there are measurements where it says a petrol car that is really, really well made and it's got catalytic converters, it's got this, it's got that, or whatever, might be for 7 years more environmentally friendly than a electric car that from the beginning with the batteries and all the electronics and everything else that it's using will become much later, you know, on par. So it's a very gray area, and it's very difficult to know whether any of these commitments will be actually made or not. There's a lot of money going after it, and there's a lot of activity. However, that in itself, as we talked earlier on, could actually backfire, because there was an article in the Financial Times not long ago where this trend of greenwashing is growing as companies are increasingly choosing not to publicize details of their climate target in an attempt to avoid scrutiny and allegations of greenwashing, because a new study shows that a quarter of the 1,200 companies in 12 countries that were surveyed said that they would not publicize their science-based net zero emission targets, a roadmap for reducing emissions in line with the goals of the Paris Agreement, because of this particular, you know, the problem of getting into trouble.
Great. Well, I think that's a great transition to my question for you, which is in terms of a term that now you and Shada have both mentioned, impact washing. So I think that it would be nice to explain that a little bit better to our audience, how they might be able to recognize impact washing through like slogans or rebrands, and also how they might be able to hold some of those firms accountable, maybe with their personal 401k investments or other stocks.
First of all, let's see, what is actually impact investment? I mean, the definition of impact investments are investments made with the intention to generate positive, measurable social and environmental impact alongside a financial return. So that's the way that it's actually been described in literature. The problem is that it's divided into three areas of intent, contribution, and measurement. So you can say, as an investor, I have an intention, definitely, to achieve a social or environmental goal by identifying outcomes. You can also say, as an investor, there is a narrative that can say, you know, it describes the investment, that contribution it can make. The problem we have is that there is no measurement at the moment on impact. There is no regulation whatsoever. So therefore, there's no system of measuring in place linking intent and contribution to the actual improvement in social and environmental outcomes delivered by the enterprise. So therefore, we cannot say, and this is really important in terms of the investment community, because we can say this is a million, as I said, 2.3 trillions have been raised. And the point is that a lot of funds are saying, we're actually an impact fund. But in reality, there's no measurement afterwards to go and say, well, did you really achieve the impact that you had intended to achieve or not? And so we have impact washing, which is when a fund manager or a bond issuer overstates or falsely claims an investment that is making a positive impact on the environment or society. And it really is a very difficult one at the moment. And I am hoping that somewhere along the line, we would have not a draconian kind of measurement, because they never work really, but some kind of a stable way of figuring out how on earth do we really measure whether an impact investor or an impact fund is actually making impact solutions or not. And of course, the demand, as I say, is so high. And then there is another major problem here, and I know I'm going off script, but it's really important for you guys to know, because if you think about the pension funds, they are actually using our money to make more money for us. So their job is to bring revenue. A true impact fund has been proven would actually have a lower, by 1%, lower returns than a normal fund. So therefore, as a pension fund, on the one hand, I'm being pushed saying, you really, as a fund manager, you really ought to go into impact investment. On the other hand, you really have an issue, because your job is to increase revenue. So how on earth you end up, you know, squaring the circle, or is it circling the square? No, squaring the circle. It's a big dilemma. I mean, it really is. The same way, for example, there's a real dilemma Do we, as stock pickers, for example, not pick any more fossil fuel companies? Because if BP or Shell or any of these people say we're going to invest enormous amount of our huge profits into renewable, and that is an area where it does need a lot of money, by not actually investing in them, by not allowing them to put more money into renewables. So it's just a very difficult area to make the decision.
So just to continue from our previous conversation, in your opinion, how have policymakers around the world responded to greenwashing, and what is missing and what can be done moving forward?
I think, first of all, I think we need much better education of both the consumer, so they don't put demands that are, I'm going to give you some real examples in this area in a minute. So therefore, mass education and getting people to really understand what's greenwashing and what isn't. And the second thing is that here in the UK in particular, there's a lot of what's called ESG litigation funds.
Sorry to interrupt, Dori. Could you please explain to our audience what are the ESG litigation funds?
ESG litigation funds are funds where investors are actually putting money and then within a law company or for a law company, and they actually go after companies that are saying they're making huge impact or they are green when they're not. But let me give you an example. Let's say a huge, big company, mining company, goes and starts attacking the nature in a village in, let's say, Brazil. I'm just using this as an example. And of course, the villagers, there's no way they would be able to take this big, humongous company into court. So what they can do is use the money that is being raised into a litigation fund by investors, and this is for profit, and they're very profitable. And what happens is that they then, the lawyers, using the funds that they raise for profit, take that big company to court. And most of the time, they settle outside court because they don't want to be, you know, plastered all over the press. But because these litigation funds are becoming more and more powerful, people are going to be more and more concerned, oh my goodness, let's not do that because we might be under attack from an ESG litigation fund.
So would you say these ESG funds will have a huge impact in the future?
So I think the role of the consumer and the government and the technology are the three areas that will settle eventually. But the ESG regulation is ESG funds are one of the areas that people are becoming a lot more scared of, saying that, you know, if we do that, we might get into trouble with one of these funds.
Yeah, so this is the last question from us today. So you mentioned consumer demand is a driver for greenwashing, but what advice do you give people to spur their critical thinking and prevent them from falling greenwashing?
I think that investing in the right companies obviously is a huge, you know, we are spending a lot of money in VCs that are looking for green products. Impact investing is, as I said, increasing. The issue again is to educate. For example, I sit on advisory of a German company called Novihome. They have come up with the most amazing technology that completely changes the world of farming, which could be very, very difficult because you can imagine that it is very, very pollutant in many ways. So it reduces this particular product. It reduces the amount of fertilizer that you need. It has carbon capture. It basically makes the products less prone to disease. It makes them much better absorbent of water, et cetera, et cetera. It's a fantastic solution. However, the source of this amazing magical product is lignite, which is coal. So therefore, suddenly, something which is so green and so helpful and in abundance in you know, already, that we don't have to even dig that far. And it's not burning it, it's actually carbon capture. But you know, if you look at it on the face of it, you would not put it as a green impact investment. You need to open it up and see, as a farmer, my God, if I take this, I need, you know, I reduce the amount of fertilizer that I need. I increase my yield. I do this. I do this. I do this. So education again, and also not sort of just jumping into saying no more fossil fuels. So you cannot say, I mean, this product is really green, but at the end of the day, if you look at it, you would say, oh, no, but it's got coal in it. Well, so what? You know, I'm just trying to be, again, far more open from cradle to grave. What are we really saying? And so, yes, social media does help. Consumer demand does help. Regulation does help. All of these have got to come, but we've got to be pragmatic.
Well, thank you so much. We've really appreciated this conversation. I know that it increased our knowledge in this space. And it's, I think that's one of the benefits of having this podcast, is we get to have conversations with folks like yourself who are so deeply knowledgeable about these topics, and then help bring that information to a wider audience as well. So we just wanted to thank you for your time.
Pleasure. Absolute pleasure. It was a really charming event. And thank you so much.
Well, on to our dumb questions. So this month we had another fabulous dumb question submitted to us, which is on cryptocurrency. And this listener, and I'm sure many of our other listeners, really find themselves curious about some of what they've heard regarding the environmental impacts of our new digital currencies and these things that are really making the rave. And I will say that I don't think it took very long from these startups getting kind of this environmental impact social media topic. It really started to get talked about. And, you know, I personally started using it as my retort every time I found myself in the back of an Uber where somebody was trying to tell me why I should be using cryptocurrency, because it was their retirement plan and I could retire a millionaire too. But I think that Leonie might be the perfect person to provide us an answer for that and help our listeners understand some of the environmental impacts.
Yeah, so to answer your question very simply, yes, it is pretty bad for environment. So, yeah, cryptocurrency is the virtual money, and NFT, non-fungible tokens, are representing things like art or music or in-game items on the internet. So they are both digital assets. These have become more popular, but there is a growing concern about environment impact. How bad it is? So we don't know, actually. There is no certain methodology to calculate the power consumption of digital asset trade process. But one research said the total global electricity use for crypto assets are between 120 and 240 billion kilowatt hour per year. That's equivalent to the total annual electricity use of many individual countries, such as like Argentina or Austria. So rather than saying crypto or NFT per se is environmentally unfriendly, the system structure is highly depending on blockchain technology, which requires a lot of energy use. So NFT is created by blockchain and traded by blockchain. When you purchase NFT, you need to pay with cryptocurrency, which is also used blockchain. So each transaction uses a mining process. So let's say a computer calculation, and it involves a vast decentralized network of computers around the world. So imagine that data center in your town, there's tons of computer servers in the giant buildings. They use a lot of electricity to run these servers and AC to prevent heat disruptions. So the more cryptocurrency or NFT market grows, the more carbon footprint increases. So for the sustainable future, the digital asset industry, so they are looking at the way to make a transaction more energy efficiency and environmentally friendly. For example, like taking off of the traditional grid and using clean energy in blockchain mining so that they can reduce the carbon emission. Also, NFT blockchain platforms such as Ethereum, so their system are upgraded to improve their mechanism and increasing efficiency of power usage.
Great, and just as our topic was greenwashing, we just have to be very careful about the new claims that crypto companies are making about using more renewable electricity. They have a lot of problem using renewable electricity for many reasons, which we probably leave it for another episode. But we just have to make sure we do our due diligence when we look at them. And thanks to all of you for being part of our program. Our today's guest was Dori Dhanahari. You can find us on Spotify by searching the name Hopkins Green Tea. You can also find us on LinkedIn by searching our name, or on Twitter by searching our handle @HopkinsGreenTea. Have a good day.